This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Lynn, first of all, your accent, where are you from?
I'm from Malaysia.
Ah, you have somewhat of a British accent as well.
A friendly enough question, but when I heard it at the time, I felt a little thrill of nerves anyway. But then that might be because Sydney Aki works for US Customs and Border Protection, and I can't help but think of all the other people he might have asked that question to before. Where are you from? It's a conversation starter almost as common as how are you, especially in countries that have a melting pot multicultural makeup, like America, and of course, Malaysia. Hello, I'm Lee Chui Lin. Welcome to the first episode of The Pendatang Cometh, an examination of immigration in America, its place in the country's history and future, and the lessons woven into the stories of the people who've crossed borders and bureaucracies to reach a new country. In this, we were explorers in a very well-trodden land of imagination, running around from San Francisco to Arizona, trying to make sense of the immigration debate. So over the next 4 weeks, you're going to be hearing what sense we've managed to make, and of course, from some of the people who've made their way to America's shores. Napa Valley winemakers, originally from Mexico.
My father started coming to California when he was pretty young. Then, you know, he started coming on what was called the Bracero program and went to work for a gentleman named Frank L. Wood, who was one of the first people to start putting in vineyards. And then that gentleman decided to sponsor him for permanent residency. And then he applied for us, and that's when he brought us up here. So that was about 1968.
Coming up here, I spent 3-4 weeks knowing that my value as professional was done to nothing, and my knowledge was diminished because how they see our communities. We're segregated, and you are supposed to come and do certain jobs and certain activities, and access to education, access to wealth, access to a lot of things were not an option.
Chinese-American entrepreneurs who grew up with Insulting Chance as a soundtrack.
Let's see, how far back do I need to go? My dad came, and my mom and dad both came to the United States in the early 1960s for college. I think this was something that a lot of families with money did in China and Taiwan when they wanted their children to be educated in America.
A formerly undocumented immigrant who went from housekeeping in hotels to owning her own home and working at MIT.
So I found out through some relatives that some of my parents, my father's cousin, had come to the U.S. and they were doing well here. And I just decided to back and go. I didn't speak any English, so it was hard coming in the first year or so. But there was no perspective for me back in Brazil.
And of course, from the people who were there before anybody else.
Even my tribe, which I'm a Dakota person, and we are roughly in the area where our ancestors hunted and moved through occasionally, but my ancestors were also forcibly relocated from what is today St. Paul, Minnesota, onto reservations in eastern South Dakota. So luckily for us, it's a similar landscape, and we could sort of continue a lot of those land-based practices, and our spirituality is often rises up in relationship to particular land bases and particular land forms. And so for us, we were, I think, able to continue those kind of land-informed practices, perhaps more than some Native people were.
Well, here I am, strapped into a metal tube, one of the miracles of mankind, on the way to San Francisco. It's depending on what the pilot has to say and what Mother Nature has to say, I suppose, between a 12 to 13 hour flight, and this is the beginning of it. It's about 6.5 hours into the flight, and everybody here is bundled up in their coats. Sleep has been kind of patchy, slow in coming, and I think I've finally given up the ghost. So it's probably time to watch the movies that I've already watched while we continue to sit here all crammed up. 6.5 hours in, 7 hours to go. It's a uniquely silly privilege, let me tell you, to be complaining about flying thousands of kilometers to another country anyway. But it gets even sillier when you consider the months, those slow, slow months that this journey would have taken in the past. The history of arrival into the United States is neither new nor especially simple. The reasons have been many. New opportunities, work, fleeing persecution, and escaping wars. There are also people who never wanted to be there. Hundreds of thousands of slaves from Africa brought against their will. Approaching the 1800s, immigration policy became a political weapon, with the four bills of the Alien and Sedition Acts of 1798 having consequences beyond what they were intended for. Now, incidentally, it might interest you to know that this particular Sedition Act was deeply unpopular and expired in 1801. But that's probably a show for another day. The point is that mass immigration has never been an unpolitical issue, even as it feels like it's heated up immeasurably in the last few years.
We don't need to take people just because they're on our border. We didn't used to take people just because they live within walking distance. We used to have an immigration policy where we would choose the best in the world, and that was changed. This is a fairly recent policy.
We would choose the whitest in the world. That's
your audience. No, we wouldn't, but we look, the pre-1970 immigrants were more educated, made more money, were more likely to buy houses, and 30% of them went home. Now no one goes home. They go on welfare, and they are far more likely to be on welfare than the native population. I think a nation's policies should be concerned with the people already here. It should be people who live here benefit, not to become the, you know, battered woman's shelter of the world, where we're bringing in the hardest cases and, you know, the wife beaters and the single mother with eight kids.
And that's something I'm going to explore later on. For now, though, I'm going to make the argument that for all the different reasons throughout history that humans have felt this need to uproot and fling themselves across oceans, you can boil it down to this. Patterns of escaping hardship, economic and otherwise. Patty Chang's parents fled Taiwan to escape imprisonment.
My dad's side of the family was living in Taiwan at the time, Hong Kong and Taiwan. They left China in the 1942 because my grandfather was a general under Chiang Kai-shek. And during the Communist Revolution, the beginning of it, they had to flee or probably imprisoned or probably killed.
Tisha Gomez didn't see a future in Brazil.
Where I lived, it was a very difficult situation. It was the middle 80s. We had just come out of a military dictatorship, and the economy was in shambles. So I was already going to university then. When I was trying to find something that I could work and keep myself or sustain myself without giving the trouble to my parents, who were like low middle class. But it was very hard, and I couldn't find a job. I was living at home with my parents in a small town. There was nothing much for me to do there other to get married to somebody local and just stay there, which was not what I had planned for myself.
And even within the United States itself, the migration of Native Americans has been motivated by the search for a better life and also the whims of its government, as you'll hear from David Washington, medicine man of the Hopi people, also affectionately known as Uncle Dave.
So the migrations, they took many millennia to get to this point here. And people ask us, why you live way out here in the rocks and deserts? This is where we're set to live, and we won't be bothered here. But now they're finding minerals and things in the earth, and they want it. They want it.
All this doesn't quite adequately answer this question, though. Why America? I mean, a better life, a better job, it makes sense to move for that. But why move to America? That's a question we'll try to answer over the next four episodes, but we'll start after the break. You're listening to The Pendatang Kamuth. I'm Lee Chui Lin, BFM 89.9.
Being raised in Laredo, right on the Texas-Mexican border, and having friends and relatives, On the other side, back when I was growing up, which was a long time ago, we would buy tomatoes in America, and we would buy avocados in Mexico. We would buy shirts in Mexico, and we'd buy the pants in Laredo. And the two cities were like sister cities, like St. Paul, Minneapolis, or Dallas-Fort Worth. And so you just put your nickel in the bridge and you'd walk across, and it was not unusual for the two cities to celebrate a parade, and it would meet the middle of the bridge. And when I was growing up as a young man and I wanted to escape the truant officers, we would go to Nuevo Laredo because the truant officers had no authority in Mexico. We would go watch Pimpy Longstocking in Spanish, and we would just have a blast.
This is part two of our very first episode of The Pandatang Cometh. I'm Lee Chui Lin, and we are looking at immigration in America and all the stories that pop up because of it. The borders between nations are arbitrary and porous, and never more so when it's just a very long, invisible line across which children can run. Dr. Alejandro Mandis is part of the Immigration Alliance, a national collaborative effort that equips churches across the country to provide legal services to immigrants. That was his memory of his childhood, but years later, life at the border still plays out that way, just with more oomph and volume.
We were very busy with cargo. A lot of manufacturing, TVs, automobiles, electronics, and whatnot. I can recall approximately $100 billion of importation of goods coming to the United States, which is huge. But the challenges that Laredo faced was the fact that, you know what, we were basically the port where majority of all of the commercial goods entered the United States, and that's very important. So the challenge was to identify and balance efficiency with all the legitimate cargo coming into the country versus individuals who are trying to use that pathway to, of course, also introduce illegal contraband and other violations into that mix as well.
So you remember Sidney Aki? He's the guy right at the start who thought I sounded British. He's also the guy who's the port director for the Office of Field Operations at U.S. Customs and Border Protection. He worked at the Laredo border, and he's now at San Diego and just as busy.
We had processed more than 51,000 passenger vehicles per day, more than 31,000 pedestrians per day, and more than 300 buses, anywhere from 25 to 45 people per bus. And that's a lot of volume per day with regards to any location and any port of entry, not only in the United States, not only in the Western Hemisphere, but also in the world. And that roughly translates into about 125,000 to 130,000 people being processed every day here at our ports of entry.
And as Dr. Alejandro described before, people cross the border for all sorts of reasons, whether it's for cut-and-dried trade or for more sentimental reasons like family.
Every 33 international travelers into the United States, we create one job in the United States. And that is huge, especially when you look at our numbers with close to 125,000 to 130,000 people crossing per day. So that creates a lot of jobs. But also on the flip side, we also see a lot of individuals going to Mexico, to Rosarito, certain parts of Baja California for vacation, visiting family, going to dinner, restaurants, and so on and so on. So we also are also building the economy and commerce in Baja California and the greater Mexico area as well. In tandem with that, of course, is the fact that we also need to do our security mission as well.
If you're coming from further away, though, and bringing your family with you, or trying to, why choose America over Australia or Singapore or Zanzibar? Well, there's the prosaic, as explained by our ambassador in the States, His Excellency Datuk Dr. Awang Adik.
Students choose to come here. Well, firstly, some of the best universities in the world are United States. The Ivy League universities, for instance, Stanford, you know, the University of Chicago. These are among the best in the world. And there are more sort of good universities in U.S. than, say, in London or England. England, probably the two famous ones, Oxford, Cambridge, London School, you know. But in U.S., we have many more, and they are just as good, if not better. These are the Ivy Leagues, Harvard, MIT, Princeton, Wharton, you know. So that's one, the quality of education. Secondly, I believe is also the interesting sort of education system. For instance, a student is much more exposed to interdisciplinary studies in U.S. compared to very much more narrowed and streamlined sort of discipline in some of the Commonwealth countries. So here they can do liberal arts, they can do double major, they can do science plus humanities, science plus social science, you know, things like that. And thirdly, the cost of living is not too bad here, the cost of living.
Or, you know, you could be starting a business, as Paul McDaniel of the Immigration Policy Center suggests.
There's a growing movement of cities around the U.S. that are choosing to implement strategies and policies and initiatives to be more welcoming to immigrants, and they recognize immigrants as one component, as contributing to one component of their broader economic growth, and so they're trying to attract more people to move to these places and start businesses and contribute to the local economy. So Nashville, Tennessee is one example, Detroit, Michigan, Chicago, Dayton, Ohio, Los Angeles. You see a big diversity of cities, but for one particular example in Nashville, they have been working to attract immigrants, and they're working with different community-based organizations in their city.
But really, people come here, and here specifically, because they're sold the idea of the American dream. More than any other country in the world, America has successfully commodified aspiration. We asked everybody we met on this jaunt whether they believed in it, whether they were living it. Here are some of the answers.
I had all the opportunities that people come here for, those that illegally cross into the U.S. are looking for. And because of what my parents did, I've had those opportunities. It wasn't easy. I mean, I remember looking back and that, yeah, often we didn't have a lot, but we had what we needed. But we did have the opportunity. We had the opportunity to work. We had the opportunity to go to school. And, you know, now to basically do whatever we want as far as developing a business or getting a job or whatever, we've had all of those opportunities. And I think that's what the American dream is.
This is a melting pot. But here, you know, whatever you say about them, they are first American. Secondly, they are very patriotic. You know, most houses, they have American flags throughout the year, not just on National Day. Malaysia, we have multicultural, you know, multiracial, but we don't have that, I suppose, the unity as strong as they do here. You know, that sense of belonging to the country, very strong here, and they're very proud to be Americans. So maybe we can learn a thing or two from here.
I think I'm not living the American dream. I'm living my dream. I have a family. I have a home. I can help my parents. If that is the American dream, I would say then it's just a coincidence.
I still find President Obama to be very much an American exceptionalist. He's got this narrative of we can do things in this country that haven't happened elsewhere. You can pull yourself up by your bootstraps. He peddles that American dream. And that American dream, it erases the fact that this country is a crime. It was born in invasion and theft of land and forced labor from African slaves.
I'm actually working for that American dream every day. So it's reinventing yourself and then setting up your new goals every time, because reality, if I settle that I said I'm actually content where I am, before I know, everything else is going to catch up and I'm going to be lost. I have to keep on reinventing myself and to work as hard as day number one.
Now that's a lot to unpack. But it's that last sentence by Alex Sotelo, Mexican-American winemaker, whose wine has been served in the White House, that I want to start with first. The American dream, it's a lot of work. Next week on The Pendatang Cometh, the rise of immigrants. How much work does it take for a community to even have a Chinatown or a little Ethiopia? And how is the system stacked against you when you don't have the right papers? Find out same time, same place next week. BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.